Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Accelerating Out of the Great Recession, a new book by the Boston Consulting Group's David Rhodes and Daniel Stelter, is a call to action for today's executives. It shows how companies can win in a slow-growth economy by seizing the initiative, differentiating themselves from less fleet-footed rivals, and executing their strategies with single-minded determination. David Rhodes is a senior partner and managing director of the London office of the Boston Consulting Group and the global leader of the financial institutions practice. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
David, you've conducted an extensive amount of research leading to this book. Can you walk us through your findings?
We undertook some research where we spoke to nearly 500 senior managers from seven countries around the world, the major Western economies plus Japan. And in March 2009, we found that many of them didn't take the prospect of the recession as seriously as we would have expected. They hadn't acted early to protect their financial fundamentals and protect some of the business fundamentals, cutting costs and so on. They were relatively complacent about the likelihood of protectionism, more government intervention. They tended to have quite an optimistic view as to how the recession would play out. In March 2009, there was clearly a lot of uncertainty as to how the recession would play out. By the fall of 2009, when we undertook a similar survey, similar set of questions with the same broad group of corporations from those seven countries, we found there was somewhat more realistic view. The expectation had moved from a V-shaped recession to almost any other letter of the alphabet you care to mention. But there was a lot of worry that we were heading for an L, a parallel perhaps with Japan's lost decade, and I think a greater sense of urgency about taking action. In fact, when I reflect on the March survey, the thing that most worried me was when we asked the managers that answered the survey what their forecasts were for economic growth in their country, those forecasts were significantly more economic than the official forecasts of the IMF, which actually led us to conclude that a lot of companies are not following very closely in their internal planning the external forecasts that are provided by very reputable economic organizations.
And a major conclusion you had was, of course, slow growth.
Yes, slow growth, but not no growth. No growth would be truly awful. But we are looking at a generation of managers that have enjoyed, with a little bit of up and down, a prolonged period of very attractive growth. And business in such a period, it's never easy, but it is clearly much easier. If you grow with the market, you could grow quite well. To grow in a period of slow growth essentially means capturing market share. This means beating your competitors, which means the competitive intensity is much higher. Now, why do we say slow growth? I think the heart of it is two or three very important reasons. In the United States, as I'm sure most people know, the US consumer represents 70% of the economy. If we're honest, a lot of the growth in US consumer spending over the last 20 years was fueled by a dramatic increase in credit, much of it low cost. A recession was avoided 4 or 5 years ago by the lowering of interest rates, and you could argue that that merely put off the evil day. The second thing is, when you look at the corporate profits of the United States, at the peak of the boom in the mid-2000s, the profitability of the financial services sector had reached well over 40% of US corporate profitability. And the analogy in my mind is that is like building a car. The sole purpose of the car is to drive around the gasoline tank. So in some respects, it's a question as to whether some elements of the American economy were perhaps slightly phony in that the growth didn't represent real economic growth driven by consumers, driven by export. It was driven by something of a financial bubble and a property bubble.
And those conditions will impact us as we come out of the recession?
The problem is the economic mainstay, 70% of the economy, is the consumer. And you have a consumer that is overburdened with debt, is worried about jobs. Those that are in jobs are actually demonstrably working fewer hours. And they're also worried about their retirement provision. Asset prices have come down, so they're feeling less well off. But secondly, they are worried for the long term, partly because of the long-term position of Social Security in the US, where it's fine if you retire now, but it's not looking so good if you retire in 15 years' time. Also, job insecurity. And there is a worry that this recession will be succeeded by a period of low growth where the economic recovery, modest economic recovery, is a jobless recovery.
Have you done any follow-up research since that September study?
We are about to launch in March another study where we will again research the views of nearly 500 executives in 7 countries. That research will form the basis of one of the series of papers that Daniel, my co-author, and I have been producing regularly for the Boston Consulting Group. If any of your members are interested, by April or so, this paper will be up on our website, bcg.com, and we'll wait and see what the research says.
So what would be some of the ramifications of your findings on future developments? It seems we're finding ourselves in an increasingly competitive global landscape.
It is a highly competitive world, but leadership's always important at any time, good or bad. But the thing that really characterizes those companies that perform well in really tough economic times is the decisiveness with which they take action, the commitment to taking action early, and the refusal to panic, quite frankly. In the book, we've looked at a number of companies during 3 particularly tough economic times: the Great Depression, the America's period of stagflation, and Japan's so-called lost decade. The companies that really excelled had very strong leaders. Just take the Great Depression. It may seem ironic today to know that Chrysler and GM really performed extremely well during the Great Depression. So did General Electric, so did IBM. If you just take those 4 companies, they were led by 4 of the most iconic figures in American business history: Walter Chrysler, Alfred P. Sloan, Thomas Watson, and Swope of GE. Leadership really matters, and what leaders need to do, particularly when times are tough, they need to be visible, they need to set realistic expectations, even if that means job cuts, shorter working weeks, job sharing, more part-time. They need to mobilize their management team. They need to be visible to the workforce. You can't do it alone as a CEO. You need the entire management team to do that. Clearly, you need to be focused on driving results, because when times are tough, the challenge of achieving those results is clearly tougher. And finally, leaders need to invest a lot more in affiliation, because when you're firing people, the affiliation factor with those that remain is potentially at least severely reduced. And leaders need to invest in retention of the talent that you need to build the company into the future. A second element would be challenging the shareholder value mantra. I think a lot of corporations around the world are held in thrall to the tyranny of quarterly earnings. It's a good discipline that management be held accountable on a regular basis, but not when investors take such a short-term view of performance. And I wonder, as we move ahead, whether good investors and good companies, whilst making sure they perform well in the short term, are going to pay more attention to the longer term and focus on taking actions today which build the long-term viability and success of the company. Another element that I think will change, and there's a lot of noise about it, particularly in the banking sector, is compensation. Compensation should reward the long-term performance of the company. Compensation should actually reward relative performance. So it's not the absolute performance of a company, but performance relative to its peers. Because if everyone's growing well, then maybe there's nothing magic that management are doing. At the same time, you should reward what management can influence directly. Clearly, having some reward associated with the overall performance of a company is good because then they have a stake in the company. But setting rewards which bear no relation to something that a manager can influence seems to me a not very useful thing to do. Allied to the shareholder value point is this notion of compensation being linked to not just earnings and profitability, but value creation. And another point, and it's particularly true in financial services, but it's true in any company, we need to make sure the rewards aren't based on an asymmetric risk where the company takes the risk and the employee or the management take the rewards. And let me pick one final area. I think corporate governance failed in many instances during the crisis. And part of the problem is that a number of boards were populated by very well-meaning people, but people who didn't necessarily understand fully the business of the organization. Going forward, good corporate governance will increasingly demand the people being placed on these boards have the requisite skills, experience, and knowledge to understand and challenge what management are doing and better hold management accountable for their actions, their strategy, and their decisions.
Exactly. Now, in a slow growth environment, do you see any focus on innovation?
Economic historians will tell you the thing that creates the real wave of growth is always innovation. There's a very famous Russian economist, Kondratiev, who, by the way, was executed by Stalin for espousing some somewhat unpopular views. He espoused a theory that the world economy empirically moved in long, slow economic cycles of 60 to 80 years. Now, there is some evidence that those cycles are accelerating, but those cycles are characterized by a period of growth, a period of overheating, a period of recession, acute recession, and a period of stagnation before the next wave of growth creates the next wave of economic prosperity. Historically, the evidence is innovation creates the next wave of growth. So we have the invention of the internal combustion engine and the commercialization of it, the commercialization of electricity, the commercialization of the steam engine as things that were engines of major economic growth. So what's the analogy for today? I think the growth engine going forward, and this is speculation, but it may well be clearly renewables and green, nanotechnology, biotechnology, material sciences, and probably some firm old favorites, which are still, in terms of innovation, capable of being engines of growth, the biopharma, healthcare sector, and possibly defense.
And hopefully, if companies pursue these, we'll see an improvement in growth
for those companies in those sectors. And it's no accident that some governments, when you look at their fiscal stimulus programs, reserved a chunk of it for investment in high-tech industries. That was partly to promote growth, and it was partly an attempt, if you look at the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, to reindustrialize the economy and reindustrialize it to create more domestic jobs in fast growth areas. That's also been picked up by some of the companies and some of the lobby movements. I was in the gym in the United States two or three months ago, and there was an advert. We're importing into the United States $1 billion of oil a day. If we invest in renewables, we could create 1 million new American jobs. And it was this combination of renewables, protectionism, and we don't want to be importing stuff. It's a microcosm of how governments and indeed electorates feel around the world.
David, in your book, you mentioned government stimulus packages. Do you expect another one in order to improve the level of growth?
There's a real challenge. How long can governments afford stimulus packages? There's some evidence that the US could continue to run up its deficit for a while, would be opportunity for more stimulus packages. The problem with stimulus packages is typically they are focused on investment rather than consumption. And part of the challenge here is to really drive economic growth. We need higher consumption in China, in Germany, and we need to re-stimulate US consumer growth. But I've already described why it's a challenge to stimulate US consumer growth. The second point is there is a school of thought which quite reasonably says all the stimulus package does is defer the day of pain, and it defers it in the hope that the factors pick up in the meantime. Third point is there's a lot of comment now that people are very worried about the exit route, and that if government stops spending, the economy could head in a number of countries into a second dip.
Will slow growth mean flatter organizations?
Slow growth provides an impetus for companies to create leaner, flatter organizations because of the imperative to control costs and become more efficient and effective. Reducing layers in the corporation and increasing spans of control, because a lot of corporations have too many layers from the chief executive down to the most junior people on the workforce. And secondly, they quite often have a whole series of managers with very small, very inefficient, unsuitably low spans of control. And when times are tough, it does provide a real focus on organizations getting leaner, getting more fit for purpose. And by the way, potentially peopling this structure with more part-time, more temporary people. Different use of contractors, different use of outsourced providers. So the nature of the corporation can also evolve, and parts of the business can literally deconstruct as well.
David, what are some of the things today's executives should be doing?
They need to protect the financial fundamentals. And this means getting their cash position in good shape, renegotiating with suppliers, postponing unnecessary spend, getting better inventory management in place, and paying down debt where appropriate. It is also true that you can intelligently reorient investment. Some investment which is perhaps in more blue sky, long-term, uncertain payback areas, reorient it into investment which you know will pay back in terms of real achieved cost reduction in the short term, or products which you know will sell soon in the current market conditions. The second thing is to protect what I'd call the business fundamentals. So really focus on efficiency. Chrysler went into the Great Depression as a small disadvantaged company with 7% market share. It had a scale disadvantage against its big competitors in a market that was contracting like crazy. So to survive, they acted aggressively to improve productivity. By the end of the Great Depression, they were producing 90 cars an hour versus GM's 60 cars an hour. They compensated for their lack of scale by being much more effective and efficient. They protected in that way their business fundamentals. There are ways of driving down costs, focusing on offshoring, outsourcing, making sure that the salaries are merit-based. I talked earlier about delayering, restructuring the organization. Now, in protecting the business fundamentals, are there intelligent ways of making sure you preserve talent? At the very extreme, during the Great Depression, GE acted very aggressively to cut costs and shed jobs, but they knew that talent was the key to their success. So they did what they could in these really, really tough times to retain their top talent. And they did this by getting some of their skilled staff to at least temporarily work in unskilled areas. In fact, recently, in the summer of 2009, this was reflected by the Dutch airline KLM, which rather than add capacity in the baggage handling area during what's clearly a tough economic time for airlines, persuaded some of their pilots to act as supervisors in the baggage area. And then there's a bunch of stuff you can do on revenue. There's strategic pricing.
Can you give us some examples?
There's lots of areas, but let me just very quickly name three or four. You can remove features to reduce price. I mean, there's a trade-off between price and consumer utility here, but which features are less valued, which allow you to cut costs and reduce price? You can unbundle the product, allowing customers to get the base product cheaper, and then it allows you clearly to lock in and potentially sell up. Interestingly enough, there's this curious behavioral economics feature if you increase price and then increase the discount, although the price the consumer pays is the same, consumers react better to the bigger discount. And then you can move into adjacent markets. During quite a tough period in the 90s, U-Haul, in a very tough rental business where the margins were very slim, introduced packaging, tape, string, all the added paraphernalia for when you move stuff. And the margins on that were terrific. And actually, that's no different from what IBM did in the Great Depression, where they shifted from selling to leasing accounting machines cheap and made their money selling peripherals. Sounds quite similar to the printer market today.
That's definitely true. Before we wrap up, do you have any other key points you want to leave our audience with?
Yes. We've talked about innovation as being the source of future prosperity. It is clear when you look at any of the great periods of downturn, those companies that invested in long-term R&D really reap the benefits. If you do this during tough times when your competitors are just cutting back, it changes the pecking order of industries and gives you sustained advantage for a long period of time. I've mentioned IBM and accounting machines. Because they devoted 6% of their turnover to R&D during the Great Depression when Remington Rand were cutting back, IBM won the accounting machine market. They went from a distant fourth to essentially very close to number one in the industry. A second example would be GE. Even during the tough times of the Great Depression, they introduced the refrigerator, the Hoover, the washing machine, and demand for this was helped because consumers are always interested, even in tough times, in really high consumer value products. And secondly, they were helped by the government stimulus, which was the Rural Electrification Program. So also looking for opportunities to exploit government stimulus and to anticipate where government's going to put money is a good thing to do. Two or three other things. Consumer behaviors are clearly changing. Some of them are changing, I think, for a material period of time. One UK executive said consumers aren't going to be drinking water from the bottle, they're going to be drinking from the tap. Anticipate where consumers are going to trade down and make sure that your product is suitable. That's what Chrysler did in the Great Depression. They went from mid-market cars to the mass market Plymouth and had the courage to launch a nationwide dealership to support and sell the Plymouth, even during the Great Depression. Another household name, of course, Procter & Gamble, during the Great Depression, saw their competitors cut back on advertising and marketing. Prices were dropping for advertising. Procter & Gamble spent big. That's where the soap operas come from. And Procter & Gamble put clear water between them and their competition. And I think one last area, the really tough companies take the fight to the competition when the competition is nervous and not acting. In the 1970s, McDonald's took the decision to open 500 branches in the US each year, and Burger King were more nervous and opened maybe 200. After a few years, this created what by 1990 the former head of Burger King called McDonald's significant market advantage, because they had built out during the recession.
Okay, any parting thoughts, David?
I'd like to end with what I started with, which is, it's not that we're in a no-growth world, we're in a low-growth world, but in low growth, it's about the depth of competitive intensity and therefore the intensity that management need to apply to their actions. They need to recognize that growing with the market is no longer an option, and this means ducking the tough decisions is no longer possible.
We've been speaking to David Rhodes, Senior Partner and Managing Director of the London office of the Boston Consulting Group. He is also the global leader of its financial institutions practice. David, thanks for being with us on Edgewise.
Thank you, David.
AMA webinars provide 90 minutes of focused how-to instruction and specific solutions for solving your most pressing work issues. For $149, you'll participate in an in-depth course taught by an expert who will answer your questions and guide you through the process a step at a time. For a complete schedule of upcoming AMA webinars, visit our events calendar at amanet.org/events. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.